Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
All right, let's do it. Hey, everybody, welcome in. It's David Summers. It's another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. This is the story of wrestling in America, as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So now, let's step back into the ring and back into time. Let's get wall-to-wall and tree-top tall with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Hey, listen, Ron, the last Studcast was really very interesting. I really enjoyed it. It has a lot of people talking about it. I don't know about you, but I had a lot of friends stopping and talking to me about it, even more than usual. A lot of those were also asking about the when wrestling was wrestling post that you've been doing for a while now, and those stand out for me, and I really enjoy those. You're doing those on your social media sites. So if you don't mind, Stud, just curious, how many friends and fans do you have on social media, or do you even keep count of that?
Well, I look at it every once in a while. Yeah, I sure don't mind talking about it. Heck, I'm proud to say, man, I think just in the last couple of weeks, I went over 20,000 of my on my three Facebook sites and my
wow.
Twitter. I guess they call it X now.
Yeah.
You know, so it keeps me pretty busy, man. I really enjoy, though, doing those when wrestling was wrestling posts. I really like that. And they have become extremely popular. In fact, I was planning to do the hidden history lesson today on two particular wrestling cards recently on when wrestling was wrestling posts.
All right, so how do you get all that information for the When Wrestling Was Wrestling post? They all seem to have exact dates and some information about the actual matches and cards from your past. How did you compile those over the years? I mean, do you just have that kind of photographic memory?
God knows I wish I did, man. That's a couple of good questions. Actually, I didn't compile them, you know, and I have a couple of friends, wrestling historians, that got in touch with me years ago, and they asked me if I would be interested in getting a chart of as many of my matches as possible during my career.
Wow.
They said, we'll list out the dates, we'll give you the city, we'll tell you who the opponent was, a winner or loser, so title information if it was a championship match. So, how can I say no to that, right? Months later, they sent me results of more than 3,000 matches.
Whoa, I was going to ask. That's incredible. Over 3,000?
3,000 matches covering my 18-year wrestling career. Pretty much everything except for the first 6 months that I was in the Georgia Territory when I first started in 1970.
Wow.
Then a lot of the smaller cities that I wrestled in during the week, in both the Southeastern territories, some of those weren't there. And some of the cities that I wrestled in Australia during my 3 months there in 1973. Mm. So looking at the matches, it's kind of like who's who in the sport, man, from 1970 into 1988.
Are they compiled or listed like from what town? See, I'm in the small town of Dothan, Alabama, in Southeast Alabama, which was always called a hotbed of wrestling. You mentioned Australia. Of course, you've done a tremendous amount of matches in Knoxville. Are they compiled and listed in from the cities?
Yes, they're listed in the cities and the actual dates.
Wow.
So they're chronological. It starts from basically 1970 when I went to Florida. And it goes all the way into 1988 when I finished up in USA Wrestling.
Do you ever look at a list like that and it just becomes a blur to you? I don't remember this or I don't remember that.
Oh, yeah, man. Of course. I mean, you got that many matches and, you know, but it's pretty fascinating, you know.
Wow.
So I couldn't do these. I couldn't do what I do with these when wrestling with Wrestling Post without it.
Man.
Because I couldn't possibly remember all the things that I have there right in front of me.
Oh, no doubt. Listen, what a great way to start this studcast. I can't wait to hear which two when wrestling was Wrestling Post you're going to talk about in our hidden history lesson today.
Yeah, the two cards I selected, man, were exactly 8 years and 4 days apart. And it's with two generations of the Welch families. In the main events on these two cards. And one took place in Atlanta, Georgia. The other took place in Miami Beach, Florida. So let's talk about that first one that happened on June the 4th, 1965, in a baseball park called Ponce de Leon, downtown Atlanta, in front of more than 20,000 Georgians.
Wow. All right, set it up for us. Who was on that card?
Well, it took almost it took place about 59 years ago exactly. And a few fans are going to remember many of these wrestlers. In fact, I was only 17 years old, but I'll do my best to describe those wrestlers that were on the card as best I can remember. And there were two matches on this card that did not get mentioned at all. They were the first. The advertisement had plus two matches at the bottom. So I don't know who those matches were, but I have the rest of the card because this came actually from one of these When Wrestling Was Wrestling deals that I've been doing. So it featured the first advertised match was a tag match. It featured Joe Scarpa and Chief Little Eagle against the Corsica brothers, one was named Gene, one was named Joe. Joe Scarpa lived only about a mile down the road from me in Griffin, Georgia. We lived in outside, about 30 miles outside of Atlanta, and Scarpa lived just down the road. Most fans are not going to recognize that wrestler's name because just a little more than a year after his match, Joe Scarpa went into the WWF for Vince McMahon Sr., and he became an American Indian.
Wait, there were three W's right there.
Yeah, W Worldwide. It's actually they had to change the name because Worldwide Wrestling Federation, WWF.
Right. Yeah,
but they had a problem with the conflict with the Worldwide. Some other type of organization was bigger than Worldwide.
It was World Wildlife. I think it Wildlife
yeah,
Fund.
Yeah, it yeah. might have been.
Yeah,
might have
yeah.
been. So you know. So that had to all change. So Vince turned Joe Scarpa into a Indian chief called Jay Strongbow.
Wow. Okay.
And wrestlers, fans up in that part of the country will certainly remember Jay Strongbow. Coincidentally, his partner in that tag match, Chief Little Eagle, actually was a full-blooded American Indian, And I used to go body surfing with him all the time when we wrestled in Australia together back in 1973, me and Chief Little Eagle. And so I never knew Corsica Joe, who was in this match, but his brother, Corsica Gene, trained my brother and I during the summer of 1970 when we both started wrestling. So, I'm not familiar with either of the guys that were in this next match, Tony Bourne or Jesse James. Mm. But I'm very familiar with all the contestants in the next match on that card. And that match was the World Tag Team Championship belt match between Kurt and Carl Von Bronner, managed by Saul Weingroff. And they were facing Ray Gunkel and Lester Welch. And so, luckily, my brother and I, we had a chance to wrestle the Von Bronners in 1971. They were, in my opinion, Dave, one of the best world tag team champions of all time. I mean, and their manager was just as good. Saul Weingroff was just as good as his team. Two big old son of a guns, about 6'4", 6'5", 250, 260, way, way back in the 60s and 70s. They were champions from the 50s into the 70s. Then Ray Gunkel, who was involved in that, was one of their opponents in this match, who was a very good guy. He was my father's partner, actually. Both of them were owners of the Georgia Territory. Ray died of a heart attack 7 years later after this match. And in 1972 in Savannah, Georgia, after wrestling in a match with Ox Baker. And his wife, Ann Gunkel, soon after Ray's death, attempted to take over the Georgia Territory. And that was the beginning of the famous Atlanta Wrestling War. A lot of different things come out of this one particular card.
Wow.
Lester Welch was my grandfather Roy's youngest brother. He was almost 20 years younger than Roy. He was close to my dad's age. So in early 1972, Lester traded his share of the Florida Territory to my father in exchange for my father's share of the Georgia Territory. This happened just before Ray's death and basically at the beginning of the Atlanta Wrestling War.
Okay, so, I mean, really fascinating stuff. So much real wrestling history right here, Stud. This brings us to the main event on that record-breaking card. I can't believe it was a boxing match with what many consider the greatest boxer of all time, Rocky Marciano, as the referee.
Yeah, I mean, and he was truly considered the greatest of all time, you know, because Rocky was one of the only boxers ever to go undefeated in his entire career. I don't know if you know how much you know about Rocky Marciano. In his career, he had 49 wins and no losses, and 43 of those were by knockout. He was an international superstar. So this card's in Atlanta. It's got the most famous boxer of all time. It's got, you know, and then the second world boxing champion, my father booked a huge match. This basically is a kind of a rematch of what took place in Mobile, Alabama in Ladd Stadium in 1958, because the two guys that are in the boxing match are my dad and Mario Galento. And they, in 1958, they were in a match in the Ladd Memorial Stadium in Mobile, Alabama, with another boxing champion, Joe Louis, refereed that match.
Wow.
Between my father and Galento.
Wow.
And some people say that the crowd was somewhere between 30 and 40,000 people.
That is incredible. And if I think if we go back, I mean, way back in the early Studcast, I think you've talked about this particular match. And it was really a lot of blood. Was there a lot of blood in this match?
Oh, yeah. I mean, both of these two matches, one in 58, the other in 65.
Wow. Yeah.
Were both bloody
wow.
matches.
Wow.
This one was a boxing match, and it was pretty bad.
Wow.
Pretty bad.
All right. That it makes this an even more spectacular event. Those two matches between these two men drew more than 50,000 people. So what happened? Tell us about the match in 1965.
Well, I watched this match with my brother, Rob, from an empty press box of this Ponce de Leon baseball stadium. We got up there and found a way to get into the press box, and we watched this match with my dad and Mario Galento. Mario Galento had his brother, Al Spider Galento. He was the second referee in the ring. He had two referees, Rocky Marciano and Al Spider Galento. And Spider didn't last very long, I remember, because he decided that he didn't like how Rocky Marciano was refereeing the match, and the dummy took a swing at him about halfway through the fight, and Marciano knocked him out. He didn't hit him with the fist. He hit him with the back of the hand in the face.
Whoa.
And they carried him out on a stretcher to the end of that round. So then the ending wasn't a whole lot different, because the fans didn't mind. And Mario thought, you know, he was a lot tougher than his brother, and he was a lot tougher than Spider. Spider was really kind of skinny and, you know, wasn't much to Spider. Mario Galento was a tough son of a gun. And toward the end of the match, Mario kind of got like his brother, you know, and he kind of made Marciano mad. And so Galindo, you know, went after him, man. Like, you know, he started throwing punches at Marciano. And he left the ring just like his brother did on a stretcher.
Wow.
Marciano knocked him out.
That had to be one of the greatest nights in Georgia wrestling history. You and Rob, you snuck your way into the press box. How old were you guys? You're just young boys.
I was a junior in high school, just headed into my senior year, and Rob was a couple years behind me.
Wow.
So you know, we're kind of taking advantage of the situation, you know. We had the best seats in the house.
Oh, absolutely. I bet you guys thought you were kind of big time sitting up there. All right. What was the hidden history lesson on this card?
Well, in my opinion, there was basically two of them in this card. They both, you know, both my father and Galindo, they had busted each other the hard way again, man. They did it big time in Mobile, and they had busted each other the hard way again. And practically no one ever knew about that, you know. So that part of it is, you know, there wasn't no big talk about when you busted somebody a hard way, that you had done it. So, you know, that fact was hidden, basically. And the second was the fact that they never got credit for two of the biggest crowds in the sports history. They had that one in Mobile with almost 40,000, between 30 and 40. And this one was more than 20,000 in Atlanta. And they never really got the credit they should have, I think, for that.
Man, I got to agree with you on that one. When you say hard way, and I know you've talked about this before, you're really talking about knuckles against the forehead. I mean,
oh yeah, talking about actually busting eyes up, black eyes and busted eyes, and wow, teeth knocked out. I mean,
that's incredible. Hey, yeah, that's why they call it hard way. Okay. All right. Listen, this has been awesome so far. Tell us about the second historic card 8 years later. I think we're going to Miami Beach on May 30th, 1973.
Okay. So I'll never forget this day, Dave. I'd forgotten about, I made an interview about this match and a week before it happened. And I was a young kid in Florida. I mean, I was 25 years old wrestling. In the main event of this card, and in Tampa, in the Sportatorium was the building where Gordon Solie and them did the TV each week. And I had done an interview, but I'd forgotten about the interview who I was wrestling on this particular night, May 30th, 1973. And it turned out that the interview was for Harley Race, and it was Harley Race's first time ever to wrestle in Florida as the NWA world champion, you know, and he was going to be wrestling me in the main event of this card. So I had forgot about the interview. So on the day of the match, like a dummy, I got up and I went to the gym and I worked out hard. And then I went to the beach and I ran a couple of miles like I used to do every day. And so I was already a little tired when I got to the building in Miami Beach, about an hour from West Palm Beach where I lived. And so imagine how I felt, man, when I asked one of the referees, I said, "Who am I wrestling?" He says, "Harley Race for the world title." I was like, "Oh my God, what have I done today, man?" So the Atlanta card we talked about earlier, it only had six matches on it. But times had really changed in that 8 years between that match with my father and Galindo and me in this match with Harley Race. And so the six matches, instead of having six matches like they had on the Atlanta card, this Miami card had nine matches on it. It was kind of like a Madison Square Garden card. I wrestled in Madison Square Garden with a 10-match card, and this one in Miami had nine on it. So as with the Atlanta card, the Miami card didn't list out the two opening matches, so I don't know who they were. But I got an idea that they were two young guys, probably like Dick Slater and Bob Orton Jr., because they were young guys during that same time frame, and they were probably on one of those opening matches. So the third match on that card was a guy named Frank Hester against a guy named Frank Martinez. I don't remember much about those two guys, so I can't say much about them. The fourth match was Tony Charles and Roberto Soto against two Japanese stars, Akai Yoshihara and Taro Kabayashi. And Charles and Soto, you know, I'm sure are both recognizable to listeners here. Man, Tony Charles has been part of all these matches, or most of them, that we've been talking about now. And Soto is going to be a future star for Southeastern down the road. The fifth match was Gorgeous George Jr. versus El Psychedelico. I don't remember much about Psychedelico, but obviously Gorgeous George Jr. was going to be working for me in both of Southeastern territories in the late 1970s, and he was Mongolian Stomper's manager. Sixth match was another tag match on that card, Dale Lewis and Tosh Togo versus Mike Graham and Kevin Sullivan. Tosh Togo, I don't really remember much about, but Dale Lewis, that was the Olympic wrestler and a friend of the family that wrestled every event I had in Knoxville through most of 1975, my first year as an owner of the wrestling company. And not only did he wrestle against his opponent, but he also accepted challenges from the audience. Then he put $1,000 on his lapel of TV every week, and if you beat him, he'd give you a $1,000 bill. And by gosh, that was undisputable proof, man, that the sport was real. Nobody ever came close to getting a win over Dale Lewis. He was a phenomenal Olympic wrestler. And their opponents, Mike Graham, Kevin Sullivan, they were about the same age as I was. They were pretty close to me. I was 25 when I had this match. And Mike was a great amateur wrestler. He was son of the owner of the territory, Eddie Graham. And Mike had been a friend of Rob and I since we were kids. And he loved to come to Knoxville, Mike. Whenever I could book him, he would just like, wow, Ron, book me. Give me on your cards. He liked to come there. Kevin Sullivan, everybody's familiar with him pretty much. He worked for me in both Southeastern territories and in Continental Wrestling. So, and he's still a friend of mine to this very day, proud to say. And then the seventh match featured two of the sport's greatest, Johnny Valentine against Hiro Matsuda. And if I could have picked or had anything to say about who would make a great NWA world champion, I would have picked Johnny Valentine. He was one of the most convincing wrestlers ever. He spent a lot of time with me in the ring, honing my skills inside the ring. And he was a definite influence on my future. I really admired Johnny Valentine. Hiro Matsuda, one of the toughest Japanese wrestlers in the world. And I also spent a lot of time with him in the ring, but in a very different atmosphere. I spent a lot of time in the old horrifying snake pit learning to shoot with Hiro Matsuda.
Wow.
So then the next to last match was a six-man tag. And these are the six wrestlers in this match right before mine. Eddie Graham, Paul Jones, and Mr. Wrestling, Tim Woods, wrestled against Buddy Colt, Dick Murdoch, and it was supposed to be Dusty Rhodes, but Chris Markoff had to substitute for Dusty. Dusty had gotten hurt. So I don't have enough time in this entire hour to say what these guys meant to me. And this was six of the greatest that ever lived.
No doubt. All right, that six-man tag right there had to be one of the best wrestling matches ever, and you were going to follow all that in the ninth match of the night.
I was going to do my best to, you know, and I went out and watched several of those matches during the course of that night, I remember, and they were leading up to my match. I watched the Japanese team's match. I watched Sullivan and Graham's tag match. They were the only two wrestlers, like I said, on the card that were close to my age. And then from inside the dressing room, I didn't have to open the door of the dressing room to hear Matsuda's chops on Valentine's chest in the ring. And Johnny Valentine, man, who had was hitting him with those hammer blows. Now, it was like, wow. and the building was going crazy. Six-man tag was really wild, and it tore the house down. So, you know, I had just turned 25 years old, and I had won my first major championship belt, the Southern title, from the great Paul Jones, tremendous wrestler, just 50 days before this night. And I guess that it kind of entitled me to a title match with Harley Race. And on this night, Dave, I had never in my life even seen Harley Race. And he had recently won the 10 pounds of gold from Dory Funk Jr. Just about 2 months before.
Wow.
And it was Harley's first run as the NWA world champion through Florida and through all the territories. And it was a short run. He only had that belt for about 2 months, and then he lost it to Jack Briscoe. So in this match with me and him, it was the first ever defense of the world title for him in Florida. And I want to bring up one more thing about this night that had a very coincidental connection, basically, to the Atlanta event we talked about 8 years earlier. The guy, Corsica Jean, that was on that card in Atlanta, the one that had trained Rob and I, so he was one of the two in the tag match on that Atlanta card. And on this night, he was the referee for this world championship match.
All right, this is a crazy coincidence. Was it unusual for a wrestler to become a referee when he got older?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't unusual. You know, many former wrestlers became referees, or maybe they got jobs working in the wrestling office when they got older. You know, it was a great way of taking care of guys that had given their lives to the sport.
Yeah.
And give them something to do and sort of give them an income beyond wrestling. So Gene came over, the referee came over from the other dressing room just before the bell rang for this match. And he told me, how proud he was. He said, Ron, I'm so proud of you, man. And just to be in the ring for this match is a thrill for me. So we went to the ring first when the bell rang. And I had become kind of a star since returning from Australia months earlier. And I just won the Southern belt. I got a tremendous welcome, man. So much so that it was one of those goosebumps welcomes before the match. You know, it was really, crowd was really into it.
I can't imagine at 25 years old being in the main event on a card like this. But the thing is, you probably stood out a little. Were you 6'9" at that time?
Oh yeah.
Wow.
Oh yeah, man. Yeah. And I was in pretty good shape too. I was a good 250.
Wow. 250,
so 6'9", 250, working out, So I was ready.
Yeah, that was far from being skinny at 6'9". All right, so what happened next?
Well, the fans and I, we got our first look, both of us. They had never seen him either, right, at the new world champion Harley Race. And wow, when he walked from the dressing room to the ring, the reaction from the fans, it was kind of quiet because they had never seen him wrestle before. They really didn't know who he was. And they didn't know what to expect from him either. And neither did I, you know. So I could tell after only 5 minutes or so in the ring, though, that, wow, this guy's really good. I mean, and he calls such a great match. The match started with lots of clean wrestling. I mean, I guess we went probably more than 30 minutes and he didn't do anything to let fans know that he was a heel at all. We were just swapping holes, and wow, it was great. Harley made me look good before he did anything to make himself a heel. But boy, when he finally did, the roof came off. I mean, so it had started, you know, with all this wrestling and a lot of clean breaks on the ropes. We ended up in the ropes quite a bit, and he just back off and clean break, and we went at it again. So suddenly after about 30, 35, maybe, I don't know for exactly how long, but after 30 minutes for sure, uh, uh, he he finally, in one of those cleans had been clean breaks off the rope, he hit me, man, in the face, knocked me through the ropes out on the concrete, busting my eye.
Wow.
And he came out and grabbed me and posted me. He ran me into the ring post after that. And then he rolled up in the ring and he raised his hands over his head like he had won. Wow. I mean, we had him, man. I mean, that building exploded. I was like, wow, they were mad. So, well, you know, and then when I came back in, he tried to pin me several times, but I fought back. And then I fought back enough that I finally had him bleeding. So then I went for a suplex and he reversed it on me and he piledrived me and he left me laying flat on my back in the middle of the ring. And then he went up on the top rope and he dived head first with his head crashing into the side of my head. I mean, the building went totally silent. I think they thought he'd kill me.
God.
Wow. You know, I kind of thought he'd kill me too. So after he got his hand raised, he covered me. He got his hand raised. They gave him the belt, and it was his first time there. Normally, in your first time as a heel, I don't care what you do in the ring, it's going to take a while for him to get to hate you. But when they gave him the belt, I remember laying there, and he had to wait for all the policemen in the building to gather around where he was going to leave the ring, and they walked him to the dressing room. His first night in, he had that kind of heat.
Wow.
So after, you know, he had, they had a hard time getting him back to the dressing room, and it was exactly what Eddie and my father and what the territory needed, was that kind of a match.
Wasn't that move, that diving headbutt, wasn't that kind of what he was famous for? One of his, I guess, signature moves.
Yeah, I mean, especially in the early part of his career.
Yeah,
and as world champion. Now, later on, he quit using that because he got hurt himself so bad doing that.
I can see the potential for that, but it's one of the things over the years that really became and made him the baddest man on God's green earth. All right, I tell you what, that's a fantastic match, and that had to be one of the best ever. This has really been amazing. So what was the hidden history in this Miami event?
Well, there was a great tie-in here between these two events 8 years apart. And the hidden history is in the fact that both events were meant to accomplish one thing, basically. They were meant to accomplish the building of the territory and the sport itself. I wasn't on this card to get myself over. I was there to get the new world champion, Harley Race, over. In the match in Atlanta, my dad wasn't there to get himself over. He was there to get his territory over, and by doing so, to get the sport over. So I was proud, man, to be carried back to the dressing room that night, and they did. They carried me out of there. I was proud because I felt like, wow, I had a great match. And I was totally exhausted after all I'd done during that day before I figured out that, wow, you dummy. Now you've got to spend, and the match lasted almost an hour, 50 minutes or so.
Wow.
So Corsica Jean, who was the referee, he went to the dressing room and followed the champ out. But then he came over to see me later, and Gene said, he gave me a message. He said, Ron, he said, Harley Race said to tell you exactly this. So Harley had told him, here's exactly what I want you to say. And he said to tell you that when he got back to St. Louis, he was going to tell Sam Muchnick that he should call you and start booking you there immediately.
Whoa. And what an incredible compliment from Harley Race. Had you ever had another wrestler send you a message like that after a match? And did you get that call?
Well, there's a great old saying in wrestling, Dave, what goes round comes round. And no, I'd never had a referee deliver a personal message to me from another wrestler before. But 2 days later, I got a call from Sam Muchnick. president of the National Wrestling
Alliance. Wow, yeah.
And he asked me if I'd like to work in St. Louis on his next card against Terry Funk. And after that match, from June 1973 until December of 1977, Dave, I looked in my chart and I wrestled in St. Louis 47 times in those 4 years.
Wow. And over time, I've heard you talk about going to St. Louis, and I've always wondered, okay, why St. Louis? It just seemed to come out of the blue. Listen, I'll tell you what, Ron, wrestling history like this is why you have done more than 350 of these studcasts. This is number 353, as a matter of fact. And this has been maybe the greatest beginning to a studcast ever. I love the stories about Harley Race because we all know what he eventually became, one of the greatest champions of all time. What a way to get this one started. Hey, I'll tell you what, this is a great spot to do our break. We'll do that. And when we come back, we're going to find out who was on the card in Southeastern in the first week of June in 1980. Going back in time once again when this Studcast continues. Listen up, Studcast fans. Super Studcasts are suddenly on fire again. The Stud has turned his relationship with some of the sport's biggest stars of all time into 3 to 4 hour fantastic recorded historical gems on his website, tnstud.com, for only $2.99 each. That's 3 to 4 hours in some cases, only $2.99 each. Just click Super Studcast and take your pick of more than 43 stars, most of them live and in person, from Bob Armstrong to Mick Foley to Terry Funk, Andre the Giant, and many more. Also, his phenomenal stories of Andre the Giant to Ron Wright to Jim Barnett, they're all there. Don't miss these. They're unforgettable. TNstud.com. Click Super Studcast and get blown away. All right, Studcast fans, welcome back in. Let's get into the second half of this Studcast. It's called, this is number 353, by the way. It is called Two Historic Events, Commissioner Don Curtis. Okay, we haven't heard about Commissioner Don Curtis. I got a feeling we're going to hear about that in the second half. All right, I don't know how you're going to follow the first part of the Studcast, but here we go. I got to tell you again, I enjoy the stories about the legend Harley Race. Rest his soul. All right, so let's get into it. What was the card for the three major markets in Southeastern? And we're talking about the first week of June of 1980. Take us back in time, Stud.
Well, we're going to try and follow the first part of this Studcast, man. And with something that was never done before by Southeastern, and I doubt was ever done in wrestling that I've ever heard of. So because the Big C had been so highly involved in his team's championship matches, getting them intentionally disqualified to save his guys from losing their belts, for the first time ever, we were going to have three main event matches, all three of those matches, Texas Death Matches. And so that was so that, because Texas and the Beth matches were no disqualification, and because there's no time limit, and there had to be a winner. So it made sense that we're going to stop our boy Big C from actually keeping his team, keeping his men as champions. So the opening match on the card was the returning Ricky Fields, who was a little star there from Mobile, versus the Cuban Assassin. Charlie Cook was facing Ted Oates, great young wrestler out of Columbus, Georgia. Third match was for the United States Junior Championship. Tony Charles was going to be defending against either Jerry Stubbs or Norvell Austin, depending on who won a Texas Death Match that's going to be on the TV to promote the card. So this is a different type of deal, too. So whoever wins this Texas Death Match on TV is going to get the shot the following week at Tony Charles for the United States Junior Championship. So in the first of these three Texas Death Matches, were next, Robert Fuller, Hetty Boulder, were against the Southeastern Tag Champions, Randy Rose and Dr. Bill Irwin, Those guys were managed by the Big C. And then in the second Texas death match of the night, I was going to be wrestling the Southeastern champion, the Mongolian Stomper, managed by Big C. And then last, the main event of the night was a Texas death match. This time it was Bob Armstrong taking on Ron Bass, and he was managed by the Big C.
All right. I don't think I've ever heard of a triple Texas deathmatch card or a championship match where the challenger had to win a TV match to get the shot. This really sounds like another special TV show.
Well, I think basically it is, man. You know, we've had some great TV shows lately, and so we wanted to try to keep that momentum going. The profile for this one was going to be kind of a history lesson on what Texas death matches were all about. And the last TV match was going to be an actual Texas death match, with the winner, like I said, getting the shot at Tony Charles. That was going to be Jerry Stubbs against Norvell Austin.
Okay, really unique idea. These TV shows lately have been really awesome. I can't wait to hear about this one. How did the show open up?
Well, this one opened up with Charlie Platt, and Jerry Stubbs was sitting at the set with him. Norvell Austin was standing out in front of the set because he refused to sit down next to Stubbs. So Charlie, opened up and he covered the card, you know, and he covered the fact that the following week, for the first time ever, there were going to be three Texas death matches on one card. And that prompted Stubbs and Austin, you know, they've been invited out there, but Charlie opens up talking about the Texas death matches. And so both Stubbs and Austin, they kind of got upset, and they go, what are we out here for, Charlie Platt? Why did you invite us out? So Charlie asked them. They said, you know, hey, just be patient here, guys. I want to get to it here, man. So he said that they were invited because of the fact that he said both of you two guys recently have wrestled Tony Charles, who's the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion, and to 30-minute time limit draw matches. And he goes, both of them had asked, they said the same, what are we out here for? You know, get to the point, Charlie. So Charlie said, you know, Commissioner Don Curtis, he said he told me today, he called and talked to me, and he says he wants you two guys to wrestle each other in the last match of this TV show. It's going to be a Texas death match, and the winner of that match is going to get a shot at the United States Junior Champion Tony Charles next week. So the TV audience popped, man. You know, they had never been, I don't think we'd ever had a Texas death match on television before and on a Southeastern show. So suddenly, man, that created an instant problem between the both of them, man. Norvell started screaming, saying, you know, hey, I won the three-man match last week with Fargo and Steinborn. And he goes, I was promised to get the championship match with Charles. And he said, I won the match. What's the deal here? You know, and he kind of had a point. And Stubbs, you know, Stubbs, he was happy, you know, with the news, you know, and he said, I'm going to the dressing room. Get ready, man. So, you know, and Norvell was still arguing with Charlie, and Charlie couldn't get him to shut up. So he told the ring announcer, ring the bell for the first match.
Okay, so it sounds like this TV was off to another wild start. Who was in the first TV match?
Well, the first match was the Mongolian Stomper, managed by the Big C.
Whoa, here we go again. The Stomper charging the studio audience, right?
Yeah, you got it, man. I mean, obviously pandemonium right off the bat, man. So when the Big C finally got him back to the ring, man, it didn't take long for the first match to be over. Because, you know, the Stomper didn't have long matches, man, especially on TV. He wanted to be a killer. And he was. And his opponent had to be carried out. He did such a good job on him. A second TV match started with Robert and Eddie Boulder at the set with Charlie. And they watched the championship match from the week before, where the Big C got his team intentionally disqualified to save their belts for him. And they both personally thanked Don Curtis for this upcoming title match, because it was a Texas death match, and that meant that there was no way the Big C was going to stop it by disqualification. And somebody was going to have to win the match.
Wow. Okay. All right. So take us to the second match of the show.
Well, the Southeastern Tag Champions, Randy Rose and Dr. Bill Irwin, managed by the Big C. This was their opportunity to have another TV match. These guys, they were becoming brutal in the ring, man. They took no pity on their opponents. And Big C loved it, man. Especially when Randy Rose, man, clotheslined his guy with his arm across his throat as he was coming off the rope. He clotheslined him so hard, the guy turned a complete flip and landed on his face. And then Rose went over and tagged in Irwin. Irwin came over and stood right over the guys laying there on his back and dropped a knee in his forehead, man.
Whoa.
So the second guy of the day got carried out. Personality profile was next, and after an entire month at this point, Charlie Platt was refusing to interview the Big C or have anything to do with him after that masked man had, after Big C had made the derogatory comments about Charlie a month earlier. So Charlie finally agreed, because I guess Commissioner Don Curtis made him, to talk to the Big C in this personality profile. So the subject for it was the history of the Texas Deathmatch, which was headlining the top three matches on the next card. And Big C had his entire entourage with him. He had Ron Bass out there, the Mongolian Stompers there with his belt. Randy Rose and Dr. Bill Irwin are there with their belts. And they're all going to be involved in Texas Deathmatches the following week. So you could tell Charlie wasn't too keen on this agreement. For this assignment, I guess I should call it, from Don Curtis. And it didn't take Charlie long to cover the rules of a Texas death match. Actually, the rules were pretty simple, but by gosh, there was a very dangerous match. There was no time limit, no disqualification. Falls didn't count. If you got beat, there had to be a winner in the match. So if you got pinned or submitted, the bell rang. You got a 30-second rest period. The bell rang again. And then you had 10 seconds to get to your feet or give up before you lost the match.
Yeah, wow, yeah.
So Big C, he was not happy with having three of these. No, what's the deal here? He wanted to know, whose idea is this? Is this yours, Charlie? They really hadn't made up the Big C and Charlie at this point. So, they were going to be, he says, why three Texas death matches in a row? And he says, two of them are for championships. And then he tried to make the point that, he said, this is ridiculous. I've never actually gotten my men disqualified on purpose. I don't need to, because they're all winners. Look at their belts. That's why they're all got the belts here, right? So Charlie had a little time for that explanation, especially when Robert and Boulder had just watched a video two matches earlier where he got disqualified on purpose, right, to save the belts. So Charlie basically just put an end to the profile. It kind of short, but okay, that's it.
I can see Charlie Platt saying that. All right, how about the third match? Take us there.
Well, fan favorite Bob Armstrong was in that one, and I don't know. I guess I need I say more, I guess is a good way of putting it. Fans just couldn't get enough of Bob Armstrong, man. They loved him. So then we got down to the fourth match, which was time for the Texas Death Match. And it was between Jerry Stubbs and Norvell Austin to see which one was going to get a shot at Tony Charles for the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship belt the next week. And Tony came to the set with Charlie and watched and commentated with Charlie over this Texas Death Match, which was a fantastic match. Both of these guys were great wrestlers, Jerry Stubbs and Norvell Austin, great wrestlers. And because of the earlier matches had been so short, this match was able to go considerable length of time. In fact, it actually went about 30 minutes for a TV match. That's a long match.
Yeah, when you're talking about a TV show, no doubt. That was a different TV show, but very interesting. So who won the matches the following week that was building all this up?
Well, Jerry Stubbs, I guess I didn't get to the part. Jerry Stubbs actually won this Texas Death Match. So he's going to get that match with Tony Charles. So Ricky Fields, he won his match against a Cuban Assassin. Charlie Cook beat Ted Oates from out of Columbus, Georgia. In the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship match, Stubbs, after beating Austin on TV in the Texas Death Match, had Tony Charles really going, man, at the end of their match, and was about to beat him. In fact, he had him covered for a pin, and so Norvell lost. He really got a raw deal out of all this because, you know, he had been promised a title match if he won the match the week before. And then after he lost the TV match, he wasn't even on the card, right? So now he's like, so he came to the town. He came to all three of those towns, as a matter of fact. And so in this particular one, Jerry Stubbs had Tony Charles pinned. And here comes Norvell Austin from now out of nowhere. And he climbs up on the top rope and jumps off and Stubbs back before the referee can count Charles out. And then he grabbed Tony Charles up and pile-drived him. And then he just left the building. So referee, what's he going to do there? He had to ring the bell. He called the match and no contest. I mean, you know, both the contestants are laying there. And a guy that wasn't even supposed to be in the building is the reason for it. So we're in the first of three Texas death matches for the Southeastern Tag Championship. Rose and Irwin kept their belts. Eddie Boulder wasn't able to get to his feet before the 10 count. And after a fairly long match, these Texas death matches were long matches, they retained their belts. In the Southeastern Championship match, another Texas death match, was me and the Stomper, and I'd taken about four straight falls against the Stomper. And so the referee at the end of the four falls, Stomper was able to get to his feet. He grabbed a headlock on me. I shot him into the ropes. He came off and hit me. I went outside the ring. He went flying back into the referee. And when the referee is down and I'm out there on the outside of the ring on the floor, guess who? Loaded his glove and he just walked over and he turned my lights out, man. I was just trying to get up on the floor to get back into the ring. He hit me with a glove, and he just went to the dressing room. So the referee and the Stomper got up inside the ring, and then they counted me out, 10 count on the floor. He rang the bell. 30 seconds later, I wasn't able to get up in that 30-second period of time and get back into the ring. And so Stomper ended up retaining his championship. Last match was between Armstrong and Bass. Wow, it was a wild one, man. Armstrong and Bass had been going at it for a few weeks here, and they had a lot of bloody ones. And the Big C got involved because it was a no DQ Texas death match. And when he did, Rob was watching. I wasn't in condition to watch any more matches. And Rob came back and helped Bob. And when Rob did that, and along came, here came Rose and half of the other guys on the card, and a parade of wrestlers came to the ring. Each one of them got in the ring, got involved. Referee had no choice but to stop the match without a winner.
That is a crazy night of wrestling. So set us up with the attendances. It had to be really big with triple death matches.
Yeah, all three major cities had crowds. Basically, we had been selling out these buildings. They were all full, and they were full again. You know, these crowds were basically about the same as the week before because we couldn't put any more people in the buildings. So Montgomery was up there around 4,600. Might have been a little bit below what they got in last time. But Dothan was 5,000, up a little bit above what it was the last time. And Mobile was another one of those sellouts. 5,600 was all that building would hold, and it sold out again.
Okay, I got to say, I live in Webb, Alabama, which is where the former WTVY television studios were, where a lot of this was filmed that built up to these matches. It's funny to me to hear you say the three major cities, and Dothan was really a small town, but an amazing wrestling town. And probably then, Dothan might have had a population of 45,000, maybe 50,000. That might be stretching it. But one-tenth of Dothan's population would attend those matches. And that's pretty amazing, matching or doing better than what Montgomery did and almost matching what Mobile did. I tell you what, this has been, Stud, in my opinion, one of the best Studcasts ever done. I've really enjoyed this. And we still have enough time for a learning tree question. I'm not going to let you slide without taking care of this. So the question comes from Michael Baker, or it might be, I think it is Baker. He did not give us the city where he lives. He asks, he says, quote, "I've been wondering about the commissioner title in wrestling. Was it actually the booker put in front of the camera, or someone sent in from the NWA who was a figurehead? Did they have any real decision-making authority?" He says, "I've always been fascinated with the ins and outs and all the moving parts." What a question.
it's a great question. And it's a perfect question for this Studcast here, basically, because we've got Don Curtis, they're talking about the commissioner here. And so I think almost every territory had someone as a spokesman of some kind for their company. It was difficult not to have somebody do it because you didn't want to have someone, that wasn't an employee of the company to speak about the special events or to take care of unusual conflicts or represent the company in public places when necessary. It was a strange little deal. A commissioner or whatever you wanted to call some people, there was not an intentionally, and I think Mr. Baker here made a couple of examples, so I can say that the booker, it wasn't the booker in disguise. I can tell you that. I never did anything like that. Or a figurehead from the NWA, and these people seldom had any authority when they were seen. So I'm probably, with four wrestling companies in my career, one of the few guys, promoters and owners, that didn't have someone to handle that for me in all four of my wrestling companies. In two of them I did, and in two of my companies I didn't. And so after what happened to me with my first company in Knoxville, southeastern Knoxville, and the problem with the Knoxville Five in 1979 and the war there, I was always concerned to put someone in that position to speak for the company, because there was no way to be sure that that person, whoever it was, after what I'd experienced, might want to just quit and not give you notice, and worse still, maybe try to take over the company. I had a real bad situation with that war in Knoxville in 1979. So therefore, my first wrestling company, Southeastern in Knoxville, I never really had a spokesman. And the closest thing to it would have been Les Thatcher, who kind of filled those shoes. And he answered everything for everybody, and without having to be someone other than the commentator. And while with Les, I trusted him implicitly. I never had to question Les's thoughts about the business. So the Southeastern Gulf Coast territory, it did end up with a spokesman, and that spokesman was Don Curtis. And basically, he was, I thought, the perfect person for that commission position. And actually, I didn't put him there. Louis Tillet was doing the booking in 1979 when he found Hulk Hogan and a lot of other wrestlers. And he's the one that decided to bring in Don Curtis to be an official commissioner for Southeastern Gulf Coast out there. Don Curtis was a former tremendous wrestler and actually a businessman, a great businessman, capable of making great impressions on anybody. And he was basically the promoter for the Florida Territory in Jacksonville, Florida. Beautiful Coliseum there. And he had been highly involved in the last two studcasts that we've done. We've had a lot of Don Curtis in here lately. And they took both of those studcasts. The time frame was in 1980. And he was always there for us, man. After Louis left, if I needed him anytime for anything, I just had to call up Don. And actually, in this studcast, you know, Dave, we put these pictures in every time we put these studcasts up. Mm-hmm. This one is going to be a picture of Don Curtis, so fans can get a look and see who Don Curtis was. And they will be able to see this son of a gun, bona fide wrestler.
Cool.
So the third wrestling company that I owned part of was Continental Championship Wrestling. Continental never had a commissioner or a spokesman, and luckily it never needed one. Last wrestling company I had for Mr. Baker, I guess, was part of, the last company was called USA Wrestling, and it not only had a spokesman, but the spokesman was half owner of the company with me, a guy named Bob Polk, and he was a trusted friend of mine for 20 years. And he was not only involved with me in wrestling, but after I left wrestling, he got involved with me in hockey as a owner with me. And after our wrestling days were over, we raised some hell and knocks in the hockey business. So I kind of hope I've answered your question, sir, and thanks for submitting it.
I tell you what, he did not ask a yes or no question, and I don't think you would answer anything with just a simple yes or no. You go into detail, and I think that's what's so cool about it. So another great answer, Stud. This Studcast has been absolutely loaded with wrestling history. I love the two fantastic cards from the 60s and 70s in the Hidden History Lesson and the Southeastern Gulf Coast card from 1980. I don't know how you're going to top this, but where do we ride in the next Studcast?
Well, you just spoke about those cards. And then next week, Dave, I'm going to introduce a new short segment that I'm going to try to do every week. And I'm going to highlight the card for the other wrestling territory up in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm going to start doing it on every show. And it will cover the same week as the one that we're going to be talking about and focusing on in the Gulf Coast territory. We're going to give you the same card from Knoxville in that same week. And then we're going to have another hidden history lesson, as well as welcome a new huge heel to the territory, my man, 400-pound Plowboy Frazier with his valet named Floyd. And we're going to be saying that we're going to welcome in the Plowboy, and we're going to be saying goodbye to somebody who's going to be in another one of those loser leave matches in Southeastern that's going to have to be going. So, and after all that, hopefully we may have another learning tree, Preston.
Wow, another loaded Studcast next week. I cannot wait. Hey, folks, you know how to contact the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. You find Ron at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud on Facebook. Like and follow him there. Automatically become friends with a living legend. The same on Twitter or X. You can find him there too. Ron Fuller Welch, follow him there on Twitter or X. You got to check out the fantastic website, tnstud.com, tnstud.com. This Studcast is going to be there with every Studcast ever done. That's 353 of these, including this one. Shop the Stud Store where you can get 43 super Studcasts, 4 different 8x10 photos, the thrilling Lion novel called Brutus, personally autographed to you, and T-shirts still on sale for the Christmas price of only $15.99, all with free shipping. And subscribe to Ron's YouTube channel, Southeastern Rewind, on YouTube. Southeastern Rewind is the first thing that comes up. Find hundreds of hours of classic old school wrestling entertainment, 428 total videos. You could spend hours and hours, days and days. The last 132 Studcast are there, 16 Ask the Stud shows, 115 short rides with the stud. Go back 1 year or more and discover fantastic stud stories about worldwide stars. 23 Studcast archive stories, 23 Tell Me More fan question shows, superstars of the past shows, and so much more. That's YouTube Southeastern Rewind. It's the best deal in wrestling, period. Any final comments, Ron?
Well, I'm looking forward, man, to the upcoming summer. I always like the summertime in the sport, and I've got some new things that I have in mind for fans, like this one that I'm going to start next week with the Southeastern Knoxville Cards. And I want to thank everybody, man, for your continued support. Take care of yourselves and others. May God bless us all.
For Ron Fuller in the great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This Studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud, LLC. Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud. This is David Summers saying so long from the great Smoky Mountains.